Hey, queer friends, are you ready to be inspired? Welcome to Season 5 of Coming Out and Beyond, a podcast that shares stories from the LGBTQIA+ community. Here's your host, Anne-Marie Zanzel.
Hi, this is Anne-Marie Zanzel, and I'm so excited to welcome you back to another episode of Coming Out and Beyond LGBTQIA+ Stories. Today, I have a fellow late in lifer on the program, and her name is Mallory Handling. Mallory is a therapist located in Philadelphia and licensed in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Indiana. Her practice, Courage to Grow Counseling, caters to the queer community, working with individuals and couples, and specializes in identity development, coming out, communication skills, and connecting with one's most authentic self. Mallory is also a PhD of Human Sexuality Program at CCIIS and is doing her dissertation on how community mitigates the impact of compulsory heterosexuality on Firefly or late bloomer identity. Mallory offers a weekly Firefly Circle peer support group where Fireflies at various stages of their journeys can come together to support and empower one another through the highs and lows to our population. Mallory, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne-Marie. I'm so happy to be here.
And I'm so happy to have you. So I would love to hear your story, Mal.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. So my story is probably going to sound really familiar to a lot of other folks who listen to this podcast, which is exactly what draws me to the community at large and exactly why I'm doing that PhD. So I identify as a Firefly, essentially. That's a more gender and sexuality expansive and inclusive term for the late bloomer community, late blooming lesbians. Not everybody identifies as a lesbian. Not everybody identifies as a woman. But we all have a shared experience of falling victim to compulsory heterosexuality and not realizing that we have options. And there's a whole fairy tale happy ending that's available to people who are queer. And so like a lot of other folks who are listening to this podcast, I met my now ex-husband when I was about 22 years old. We dated for a while. Prior to him, I had had a same-sex relationship with a woman, and it was very turbulent for reasons other than queerness. And my parents saw me struggling in that relationship, and I mistook their concern regarding the turbulence of that relationship for rejection. And so what I did was I went back far into the closet as far as I could go and married that nice Jewish boy that I had always been told was going to make me happy my entire life. And so I found him and, we got married, and it was a really good friendship. We had a lot of similar interests. We, you know, really connected well, on like an interpersonal level, but there was always a problem. There was always something wrong. And that really had a lot to do with our physical intimacy. And I really struggled with depression. And we also, engaged in substance use together. We smoked a lot of weed together. And I realize now in hindsight, in retrospect, that we were both coping with a knowing that something was definitely wrong between the two of us. And we kind of just checked out and moved on. And, you know, one day at a time turned into a couple of years at a time, turned into a few years at a time. And 7 or 8 years later, fast forward, I really had like a spiritual awakening, if you will, where I just kind of realized that I couldn't keep doing what I was doing anymore. And, you know, as many people on the podcast have done, I had a series of very hard conversations with him, where I was like, listen, I am realizing that I really miss women and I'm not really sure what to do about this. But I wanted to let you know. And he was like, listen, I love you. Let's figure this out together. And he was very kind and compassionate about it, which is not everyone's story. And I got very lucky, very privileged there. And so we explored non-monogamy for some time. We had two girlfriends. We were in a throuple twice. The first one was really great. And she ended up being a really good friend of mine for a very long time after Rafi and I stopped dating. And after the three of us stopped dating. And then the second girlfriend we had happened after he matched for residency. And we had to uproot our entire lives and move to a different city. We moved to New York City, we moved to Hoboken actually. And I was very isolated and very alone. I didn't have my people. I didn't have my job that I loved. I didn't have my clients that I loved. And I really gave up everything to be the dutiful wife and follow him through his academic and professional journey. And I look at that time now, it was very deeply painful. And I look at that time now, and you know, he actually gave me the option. He's like, listen, if you want to stay in Philly, we could do a long distance thing for a while. And I really just didn't feel like that was acceptable. I felt like I needed to like be the best wife, be the best version of that. So I did follow. And in looking back at that time, I needed that to happen. I needed to be that uncomfortable in order to make a change, because I could have gone on indefinitely, I think, being that comfortable. And I think that that's a way that particularly women, but many folks are socialized to prioritize other people's comfort over their own. Mm-hmm. And you learn to live with a certain level of discomfort, a certain level of alienation from oneself. But that really pushed me over the edge. We had a girlfriend while we were there for a couple of weeks. And I kind of realized that the women that I was looking for, trying to find our next throuple, were really women that were going to be interested in both of us. So more femme presenting, bisexual, and definitely not what I would have normally have swiped for if I was swiping for myself, which would have been more masculine of center, more androgynous, non-cis men, and, you know, kind of being really open to the smorgasbord of available humans. But that's not what he was interested in. And I was making a lot of compromises and still not having the kinds of experiences that I wanted to. And at that point, I went to him and I had a moment where I was like, listen, I'm realizing that I'm a lot gayer than I thought I was. And I don't know what to do about it. He's like, well, I'm not doing an open marriage entirely until you're saying that it's open marriage or divorce. And I said, I don't want to give you an ultimatum that doesn't feel good, but also I think that it's an open marriage or divorce. And he said, okay. And I spent about 24 hours kind of playing that tape forward and imagining what it would be like to know myself in that dynamic and know him in that dynamic. And I imagined that I was going to fall in love with someone else, most likely a woman. I didn't want to watch him fall in love with someone else. And I didn't want our story to end in heartbreak in that way. I didn't want to end in harm caused to one another. I wanted to end on a loving note because we had a really beautiful friendship. And so about 24 hours after I accepted this ultimatum or gave him this ultimatum, I said, listen, I don't think that this is going to work. I'm really sorry. I need to leave. And then, you know, within, it was really quick. Within like 3 weeks, I think, I found a new place in Philly. I found a new job in Philly. I made a triumphant return and started living my big gay life here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. At that point, I became really interested in working more with the queer community. I'm a therapist by trade, and my work had primarily been about like other topics that I felt particularly interested in and had proclivities towards. However, I felt really drawn at that point towards working with the queer community and integrating that more fully into myself and my world. Mm-hmm. And that's when the idea of Fireflies kind of started percolating. And that's when I started building my private practice, Courage to Grow Counseling, and really wanted to find that niche. Mm-hmm. And then that was in 2017. Since then, I've had a few long-term relationships that didn't work out, thank God, because now I am in the most beautiful, loving, fun, just secure and exciting relationship with this wonderful woman, Amanda, who is my fiance, and we are going to...
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're really excited. And, you know, she's the why. She's the why that, you know, everything else made sense, which didn't make sense at the time. I neglected to mention that, like, in the process before telling Rafi that I was really missing women, trying to understand our challenges, like why we weren't connecting, I sought a lot of medical answers. I sought like every other answer other than the Occam's razor, the most obvious answer, which was that I'm gay. And that was, you know, that took the form of individual therapy, couples therapy, sex therapy, coaching, and then a lot of medical appointments. I wanted a biological reason. I wanted a physiological reason for why my body wasn't responding to this person that I cared very deeply for. There was like a disconnect there. And so that manifested as a ton of blood work and a ton of doctor's appointments and discussions of procedures and medications. And ultimately, the kind of the tipping point of that line of exploration was a doctor who suggested, like, we can't find anything wrong in the labs, but if you want, you know, it might be worthwhile to do an exploratory surgery and see if perhaps there's like some endometriosis or something out there like that that's like causing this pain. And I considered it for a long time, and I was like, maybe I'll do this thing, because I just desperately wanted a different answer. And then luckily I didn't go through with that, because they wouldn't have found anything. And then, you know, the rest of the story that I've already shared. And here we are today. And I am,
I've got a bunch of questions for you.
Please, I'm very happy to answer them.
Okay. So looking back at your relationship with your ex-husband now, do you see it in the sense of bargaining? You know, the opening up of the relationship, like a lot of times, you know, I do believe Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief are particularly applicable to the later in life community. Absolutely. Because we are dying to a sense of self.
Yes.
And her original studies were on people who were dying. And I often see that people opening up their marriages, practicing polyamory, as a bargaining stage. They're in it, you know, for sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's, you know, 3 or 4 years. So now looking back, do you see it as like you and Rafi were trying to save something that just wasn't possible to save because you're not straight?
So are you in the process of coming out later in life? Are you feeling isolated or lost, cut off from friends and family, or just trying to figure out what is the next step for you? Well, I have a wonderful coaching program called Lotus Group Coaching. It is for people who are female identifying, cis or trans, or non-binary folks comfortable in those spaces. And we provide emotional, spiritual, and intellectual support for people who are in the process of coming out later in life. We discuss many things in our community, but what's most important is that you have a community of others who understand. Each one of the coaches in the program have come out later in life, and everybody who is a member of our program is somewhere in the process. So if you are seeking community and you want a soft place to land, go to my website, AmoryZanzel.com, and book a connection call. We would love to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us, that was true. And for other people, it's not true. Mm-hmm. So I think for other people, ethical non-monogamy, polyamory is absolutely a wonderful way to repair something that feels broken, something that feels incompatible, like a dissemination of needs and expectations of not one person kind of carrying the entire load of being all of the people to one person. And I think that that can be great. That wasn't our solution. That was me trying to make something that just didn't fit.
Well, I have found in our later in life community that so it's interesting, because I've talked to people that like are therapists that are polyamory experts and have practiced polyamory for their entire, you know, life. You know, I do think polyamory is an orientation, just like sexual orientation.
Yeah.
And they often say that they feel like if somebody goes into polyamory or open marriage to save something, that often it's just a temporary gap and a temporary gap measure. Yeah. And I'm curious, in your work with your fireflies, have you seen people like do it for a while and then just realize this isn't what they want for their lives? Or like, how many people have you seen be successful from it, from the later in life community?
It's a very small proportion compared to the ones that look for poly as a solution. And exactly what you've mentioned with the other poly professionals that you've worked with, if you look to poly or ENM as a solution to a problem, as opposed to incorporating a part of who you are into the relationships that you want to have, then it comes with so much pressure, right? It has to be the solution. And that pressure is ultimately, I think, the demise of this other relationship that might have prompted the exploration.
Well, and I also sometimes especially for women who are like, did you realize that you might be, you didn't realize you were gay until you had been in these relationships for a while. But for the women that like sort of realize they're gay and they want to go and explore and their husband, I'm using air quotes, gives them permission. And there's often what we call the one dick rule. I find that sometimes what couples don't realize is that you're bringing a whole nother person into your relationship with their own thoughts and their own feelings and their own wants and their own needs.
Yep. So I have two thoughts based off of that line of inquiry. One is that I have a colleague, or a classmate rather, Sally Johnson, Dr. Sally Johnson, who just defended, and she's actually doing work kind of rebranding unicorns because of the bad rap that the unicorn has, the stigmatized one. And she published a paper that's something along the lines of like, you enjoy being a second class citizen. And so when an entire human is brought into a dyad as a solution, the amount of pressure that's put onto that person and like the negligence, like I kind of cringe when I think about the ways that Rafi and I didn't properly consider Kristen and Ximena's feelings and needs and attachments. Lesson learned and moving forward.
Yeah,
and,
like, I think it's like a lesson,
like in earnest. But yeah, it's a whole dynamic and a whole set of new dynamics with each individual dyad that happens within the polycule. So I have that thought. The question that you had about whether or not I knew that I was gay. So I had dated, Steph before Rafi, and actually in hindsight, my first sexual experience was with a woman, but I didn't count it because of compulsory heterosexuality and invalidating sex relationships, right? Like how else are girls supposed to learn to kiss? They practice on their friends and like, is that really? And so something that my therapist said to me was really an eye opener. And she said something along the lines of like, just because you have nerve endings that enjoy sex sometimes with a penis doesn't mean that you're not gay.
And oh, absolutely.
And we forget that like bodies are wired for pleasure. And if can elicit pleasure from a source that is not necessarily aligned with our mental, intellectual, emotional needs.
Spiritual needs, right.
Spiritual, thank you, including the spiritual. We get confused, or we can get confused.
Well, I put it much cruder than that.
Yes.
My ex-husband's uncle was gay. And he used to say, well, friction is friction.
Yes.
And so one of the miseducation out there is that you can enjoy having sex with a man or any other type of person and still be a lesbian because it's about pleasure and it's, but who I want to go home to at night is a woman because as a queer woman, the only person that will meet my needs is a woman, like, as you said, emotional, spiritually, physically, and sexually, intellectually. So that's who's going to meet my needs. A man can't. And it's not that it's his fault. It's just the way I'm wired.
Try really hard.
Yeah. Right? And a lot of people try really hard. A lot of couples try really hard. Yeah. I really want to talk to you now about the medical intervention because I've never had anybody talk about this on the show. So it's interesting. I'm in some of like postmenopausal groups or, 45 plus groups of straight women, gay women. So many women talk about the dysfunction they have in their sexual relationship with their husband. whether it is, you know, they've done everything. I've had clients who've done hormone therapy, all kinds of stuff to try to get interest in having sex with their husband. And I'm a little bit of an instigator because I'll say, have you ever considered your sexuality? It's absurd.
Thank you for doing that. We need more people.
And I'm like, oh my God, I blew somebody's mind.
Yes.
But the thing is that why isn't that the first question?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And it's a complicated answer.
Okay, tell me that.
Yeah, so this was actually a very large section of my lit review for my lit review comprehensive examination for my PhD. And one of the reasons is because of really poor sex education. As you were mentioning before, the miseducation of sexuality, particularly in the United States. Mm-hmm. Sex education in the United States really is about preventing pregnancy, about STIs, about consent, which is all great, but it completely ignores the idea of pleasure.
Correct.
And it is also, the curricula are tend to be male-centric, and they tend to focus on penis and vagina sex, and not other types of sex or other types of pleasure. And so, not focusing on pleasure, when it gets left out of the conversation, people who have vulvas aren't necessarily educated to know that their pleasure is important. They in fact get normalized, or the idea of pain during sex becomes normalized, right? Like popping a cherry or, you know, something like that. Like the idea that there should be blood. There should never be blood, right? Mm-hmm. Unless like you're into blood play, which is like a whole thing and you got to do it safely and like, you know, teach their own. I'm not going to yuck anybody's yum, but like, it should never be painful in a way that you are not welcoming. And we don't talk about that. It doesn't get brought into the conversation from a young age, from, you know, whatever appropriate age you deem. And so that's part of it. The other part of it is the people-pleasing component, anthropologically, sociologically, that women, and I'm saying women inclusively, you know, anybody who's been socialized as a woman, internalizes over their entire lifetime. So the idea that men, boys, you know, whatever that means, is are aggressive. If they hurt you, it's because they like you. That they didn't mean to be so aggressive. It's just their testosterone, things like that. We learn that we're supposed to accept that. We're supposed to forgive it and be permissive of it. And on top of that, we learn to put other people's needs before our own. The idea of a selfless woman, the idea of the woman who can do it all and puts everybody's needs before their own, and, you know, juggles it all and is a superwoman, is like this lauded like martyr complex that is rewarded in our society.
It is,
and
absolutely.
And so like when we get the positive reinforcement from that discourse, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we continue to do the thing. And so there have been a lot of studies, which are included in the lit review of my dissertation, that or will be, that women will often not speak up about painful sexual experiences because they are worried about hurting the feelings of their partners, who tend to have penises in these dynamics. And especially with fireflies too, like those habits die hard. And so people with vulvas who are engaging in relationships with non-cis men, or with non-cis men, are also not necessarily speaking up about any sexual discomfort or pain that they might be having, because they've learned over time that it's not worth it, that their discomfort's going to be dismissed or devalued, or invalidated. And that happened to me often. You know, when I was in my couples therapy, when I was in my sex therapy, when I was at the doctor's offices, the first thing that they jumped at was like, oh, well, let's get you on birth control. I'm like, I'm not interested in the birth control. Like, oh, well, it's going to sort everything out. It's going to balance your hormones. And like, my hormones were fine. It was a desire issue. And so we also don't talk about the differentiation between arousal and desire, and how things can be discrepant. And so in order for physiological sensations to occur, oftentimes it becomes necessary for there to be desire. So we don't see the arousal, we don't see the lubrication, we don't see the engorgement, we don't see any of that without intellectually, mentally, spiritually, emotionally getting excited about the prospect of engaging in this really vulnerable thing with someone. And also, mm-hmm. that's not necessarily always the case of all sex, but when we don't talk about, you know, the foreplay, when we don't talk about the idea that like pleasure is important, then it gets dismissed and it gets invalidated.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it? I think I read once the clitoris wasn't mapped like biologically until 2009.
Yes.
Which when I read that, textbooks until 2009. I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, I just assumed somebody would have been interested in it.
Only that, we're still learning things about the clitoris. We didn't realize that the clitoris is an entire organ, like it's a shaped organ that has like, you see the part that's on the outside, the bulb or the head, and then there's also the glands. And then there's also bulbs on the inside, which is what has been mistaken for like the G-spot. It's not a whole separate anatomical structure. It's the internal structure mm-hmm. of the clitoris. And mm-hmm. none of that had been discovered until after 2000, like, which is like just...
Well, I guess it goes to, though, that the only people that they allowed to be scientists were men.
Yes.
And men didn't have the interest in, I mean, I wish we had some amazing lover that wanted to know what how to please.
Wouldn't that be incredible? And you know what? Like, I don't want to like shit on men. Like there are some men who are very interested.
Oh yeah, of course.
But also like imagine if women were encouraged to become physicians and surgeons and scientists and researchers at a rate that was higher than it has been historically. The mm-hmm. amount of knowledge that we might have about female pleasure, about you know, someone who is
female bodies, because women and men don't react to medicine the same way. We just don't. Yeah. So we're physiologically different. So yeah. I find this that you know, sometimes when I like these are things that I know and I hear you talk, and I just sometimes feel really discouraged because there's so much like unpacking to do. And I feel very privileged that I sort of know this stuff. And I know so many people don't know this stuff. And I am just like, I feel like when you come out later in life is that your lens shifts. You know, I have said, you know, I went from an armchair feminist to an actual feminist because I was living in a place of privilege and never had to do some of the things that so many women have done way before me and stuff like that. Yeah. And as my lens changed when I came out and I went from, you know, the top of female privilege, I'm white, first of all, that will never go away. Mm-hmm. I'm white. I was married to a man that was successful. I had my own career. I had 4 beautiful children, above average children. Like I had checked all those boxes. Yeah. And then when I started to lose that privilege, you know, going from, you know, a married woman to a divorced woman in this country, you know, I fell. And then when I went from being married to a man to being married to a woman in the South, it went boom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's been like, it's been such one of the greatest joys of my life. But sometimes I get, when I hear you talk about this stuff, I get so, and other people that I've had on the show, I just get a little discouraged because I'm like, there's so much work to do. I'm running out of time. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, you know what I mean?
I know.
It's like, oh my gosh, I want to just go out to the generation of teens and 20 somethings and say, you know, do the work you need, you know, get your education, do the things you need to do and help us change this world because it's pretty sad, you know, and it's pretty sad that, you know, they want to put you on birth control and you don't even need to be on birth control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the younger generations are working on it and they're doing a great job. And I think a lot of my fireflies are seeing that too, where like they'll come out to their kids and their kids are like, all right, cool. Like, are you happy? Like, great. I don't, okay. It's like not a thing. And like, you know, I have a lot of fireflies who have teenage kids and like their kids and their kids' friends are all in like poly relationships and like doing their thing and like ethically non-monogamy. Like they are breaking the mold. And so they're there.
And you know what? Probably at the end, I mean, I know we have 30% you know, Gen Z's identifying as LGBTQ, probably at the end, some of them will realize that they're straight. But the thing is they got to go and explore.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that'll make sometimes better marriages in the end.
Absolutely.
You know, as long as they marry someone that also has gone and explored. But like, it's just like, I think giving people the option to go and if I had that option to explore all of this, you know, when I was young, I would not have gotten married.
You know, I did explore when I was young and I still got married. And that's like, that speaks to the power of compulsory heterosexuality and the way that our society rewards heterosexuality and the way that it interpolates and kind of reifies the idea of that happy ending, that Prince Charming, princess, happily ever after. We see it in the movies, we see it in books. The representation is all heteronormative with a very, very small exception. And we're seeing more, and that's wonderful. And I have to imagine, and this will be part of my research, is that it correlates with the rise that we're seeing in the late in life or Firefly community. The more representation we have, the more community building that's happening, the more outreach there is and visual accessibility on TikTok and Instagram and all and Facebook groups and all of these things, the more that we're seeing these stories, the more that we're hearing the happily ever after of non-hetero relationships, the more people feel brave, the more people feel empowered and supported and bolstered by their community, and they're not going to be left alone to struggle. The struggling alone is just so painful. And like when we talk about, you know, shame and the way in which a Judeo-Christian society shames a non-heteronormative individual into thinking that like they're wrong or deficient or, you know, a sinner for doing anything that's like non-heterosexual, the shame is so powerful that it keeps us stuck. And so when we have people who have overcome that shame, who have built community around a shared experience, and who are able to find hope, you know, in similar stories, it shifts everything and it reduces the power of the shame. And I'm not saying that it's only based in organized religion, because it's certainly not. We see it.
It isn't. It's very interesting. Even children that have been raised by very progressive parents, you know, their parents like flip out when they come out and they're stunned. They're absolutely. I met a woman whose mother was she was a teacher and she was the head of the GSA. In the high school that she worked at, she thought her mother was going to be fine. Her mother hasn't spoken to her in like a couple.
That's so heartbreaking.
I know. And, you know, what I hear, that you and I both agree community is everything. And that's really what changes things. So let me talk to you a little bit about your Firefly community. So tell me what Firefly means and why did you choose that name?
Yeah, thank you. So Firefly is a term that I came up with. It started in like 2017, 2018, and I didn't kind of present it to the world until 2021, I think, in June on TikTok. And essentially, I found that like I wasn't entirely secure in like a lesbian identity for myself. I had an experience with a cis man after my marriage ended and like enjoyed it. And like we talked about before with like friction is friction, like whatever. And I was like, does that make me bi? Does that make me pan? Does that make me somewhere in the middle? I don't know. And so I had a hard time with like the late blooming lesbian moniker. And I was like, I can't be the only one. And then I, you know, met some people who came out as trans after going through this process. And I was like, all right, well, this is definitely a process. I'd like to think it's a metamorphosis. And then I was like, you know, getting more and more integrated into the queer community and hearing about like unicorns and otters and bears and like all of the different like terms that we have.
We use. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, all right, like, cool. Let's go there. And so I was like, something that has a metamorphosis, butterfly. Well, you know, mariposa in Spanish can be a derogatory term for a gay man. So I don't want to use butterfly. And then I like go to the Google machine and I'm like, all right, what goes through metamorphosis? And firefly pops up. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like, I like fireflies. We dig fireflies. Let's take a deeper look into this. And I saw that in their life cycle, they spend most of their lives underground. And when they emerge as their most authentic self, they glow and they bring joy to others. And I thought that just felt so perfect, because once I stepped into my authentic self, and left my marriage and, you know, really claimed my queer identity, I felt like there was a glow, and I was told by my people that like I looked different, I looked lighter, I looked well. And so that idea of like a firefly glowing after, you know, becoming its authentic full self felt really appropriate.
Well, yeah, it's so funny because when I first came out, like even my children said, "Mom, you're glowing."
Yes.
Because I think it was finally being, I really love, first of all, I do love the meta. I'm not a name person, so that's not something that, you know, I'm comfortable with, but other people are. Like, you know, Lily is a name for the late in life lesbian mm-hmm. community. And that started from the first Lily group that happened in 2016. Yeah. Now there's a big club Lilies online for people that are late in life. And I never really liked the Lily thing. I think it's just who I am as a human being, you know,
sure.
That was stood for late in life lesbian. But what I like about Firefly is that once you transform through this experience, your light can guide others.
Yes. So another fun fact about fireflies is that they have a very specific glow pattern. Each species mm-hmm. of fireflies, so it's a very specific glow pattern. And I feel like that's appropriate, right? Like I feel
yeah,
like
our
pattern can attract mm-hmm. the same kind of people or the right kind of mate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And what's cool about firefly too is that like you don't have to have arrived at a definition for yourself, right? Like you're someone who doesn't like labels. And so if you go into this process and you've gone through the compulsory heterosexuality and the grief and all of this and have had those hard conversations and you're like, I don't know if I'm a lesbian, I don't know if I'm bi, I don't know if I'm trans, I don't know if I'm NB, whatever, firefly still fits. You don't have to have arrived at that place of like having to go back and like come out all over again as something.
But it's also very normal for people to try on every letter of the alphabet mafia. That is incredibly very, very normal for folks to do. Yes. And so, and also too, like I define myself as a lesbian, but I also define myself as queer. So I call myself a queer lesbian because like the whole gender thing for me is sort of nebulous. Absolutely. And, you know, and so queer just fits and that's what I use. But it's also too, like, it's very, and I think also too, I think that has something to do with when you come out. Mm-hmm. I call it like, I'm like the class of 2016. It sounds like you were the class of 2018, something like that. Yeah. And the thing is that when you come out, the sensibilities of the generation that you're coming out with is often very, very, it's shaped by then. So like Barb and I, who's my other coach in Lotus Group Coaching, you know, both of us are very comfortable with, you know, not, you know, with all the gender definitions of all the things that are out there. We're very flexible, but I find people that have been out for like 30, 40 years often struggle with all those terms because they have been a bit, you know, like my wife who came out in 1985 says it was so much easier. It's just gay, lesbian, and bi.
Sure.
You know, and
easier
so,
and harder too, right? Like easier in the turn in the way of like you can find your community pretty broadly. Mm-hmm. Like it's a broad brush, and like you're straight, you're not, and like that's where you fit. But then harder in terms of like, well, also maybe it doesn't quite fit, right? Like maybe like I'm not entirely feminine or entirely masculine, or maybe I'm not entirely gay or straight, and like, you know, the bi invisibility, the biphobia is very real.
It is
very real.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So it's wonderful that like something like Firefly can allow you to like traverse any of that and do that exploration and like find your people just based on that shared queer experience of having to have those really hard conversations and going through that grief. And that was really what I was going for with the Firefly idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So people are listening to this podcast and they say, I want to meet this Mallory. How can they find you?
I can't wait to meet all of you. There's not enough time in the world to meet all of you. I'm so stoked. the website is CourageToGrowCounseling.org. And you're welcome to check that out. And then also I have the Firefly Circle group. There's a link to that on the website. We'll probably open up a couple extra sections of it to accommodate any needs that might arise. And then I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. Instagram is the Firefly Journey. It's a very young account that I just need to motivate myself to make content for. And then I also have a TikTok account, which is Mal's Courage to Grow. And you'll find the original Firefly video there.
Oh, cool. I'm going to go look at that.
Yeah, it's so fun. I got like a little piano version of Owl City's Fireflies on there. It's
So I end this program by asking three questions. So what is your coming out song?
So it just sounded like I said that Owl City Fireflies is my theme song. It's not. The song that really resonates, that has resonated with me for over 20 years, is Drive by Incubus. Essentially, the lyrics have to do with whether or not you're going to allow fear to direct your choices in life, or if you're going to be in the driver's seat. And I think that in my coming out journey, I allowed fear, the loss of privilege, the loss of partnership, being alone, you know, uncertainty, all of that stuff. I let that make my choices for me. And it wasn't until I started taking the wheel, when I started deciding which direction I wanted to go in and not allowing others to decide that direction for me, that life became better and easier and fuller.
I understand. So what book or movie changed your life?
Oh God, there's so many. I'm going to be like really basic and say that Untamed.
I was surprised you put it there.
I hate that it's the answer, and I love that it's the answer, because it's our stories. It's the ways.
I'm not going to diss Glennon Doyle, because I will get slaughtered if I do that. I was surprised because, that you put that as one of your books, because it is sort of, it's almost like a trite answer now, right? Yeah, but it is, but she does, for the first time, bravely, in the best way she could, talk about this whole journey. I believe she wrote it too soon. I think she needed to wait and process some of the stuff that was going on with her before sharing. The book would be different today, I am very, very sure, if she had given herself a couple of years, you know?
I agree. I think that Untamed, for all its glory, for all of the good that it's done, is also extremely privileged. It's written by a white cisgender woman, and we have to really think about what that meant for her journey and the relatability of it, the ubiquitousness of it, because it's not everyone's.
Not most women's journey. And as the majority earner in her family, she had a lot more privilege than a lot of the women have. And honestly, Mal, that's exactly what I have said about the book when I read it, because I was really excited about it when it came out. But then when I read it, I just realized that there were so many things missing in it. And I bet I would really love for her to go back maybe in a couple of years and rewrite that story, because I think she was, as we call them, a baby dyke. And her perspective, I am sure, has absolutely, I would have written a book like that probably when I was, well, I didn't have the privilege of being the majority earner, but if I had written that book, right, like even my memoir, I would change it now. It was written about 4 years ago. I would rewrite it if I had the opportunity, because my perspective has changed so much.
And isn't that the most beautiful thing in the world, right? Like if you're sitting here and you're thinking about when you wrote these things and you're like, oh, I would write it exactly the same. Like that means that you haven't evolved, like you haven't grown. And so the fact that you can say that so securely means that you've already, like you've continued to work, you've continued to grow and evolve with the world that you've cultivated for yourself. And I think it's gorgeous. And I think, you know, I hope, I imagine that Glennon would do the same thing with her book. And you know, we're talking about dialectics here, right? Like it can be both of this, of those things.
Both true at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. It can be something that was like so meaningful at the time and like really like prompted a renaissance. And it could also be something that like isn't complete and that like had a lot of missing pieces and like, you know, leaves a lot to be desired. And I think that that's really true of like most things in life, is it can occupy both of those spaces simultaneously. Well,
and also too, she's helped enormous amount of straight women who were her followers.
Yeah.
And she opened a lot of people's eyes, whether you're gay or not, because a lot of the people that really love Glennon Doyle's book are not gay, but they realize they have lived their life as the cougar or the leopard. Cheetah, thank you. Yeah. And so the metaphor she used, oh my God, beautiful metaphor. Yeah. Beautiful metaphor. And I think that hit a nerve of a lot of people. By the time I read that book, I was already out. Yeah. And so, but if I had still been in the closet and still trying to figure everything out, I think that that book would have changed my life. You know,
I think the thing that stuck with me the most, or like that was the most like impactful, was the socialization of women for mm-hmm. me, not necessarily the coming out part, but like the ways in which we were taught to be small and not take up space and put others' needs before ours and not be, you know, the authors or the illustrators of our own lives. I think that that part of Untamed was the part that like really like hit that nerve where I was like, this is everyone, like all women are going through this process. And like, you know, it's, and it varies, right? Like intersectional feminism has to consider all of the ways in which different women navigate the world differently and have different access to resources and privilege. But there are some underlying themes of like devaluing ourselves and making ourselves small and taking up less space that we've internalized because it's been force fed.
I'm actually just thinking about that she's very public about, but Glennon has always talked about her battles with bulimia. Mm-hmm. And I think about like even physically trying to make herself smaller. And she is a very tiny woman, by yeah. the way, but like, you know, it's like even physically she was trying to make her. We could talk about this for hours. Okay. You also said Bossy Pants, which I love. That was a great book. And Amy Poehler's. I love both the second choices. I think those are just amazing books about women who have taken control of their destiny. I love Tina Fey. She's like one of my, like, I would love to meet her kind of person.
Yes. And Amy Poehler. And the two of them together, I just saw the Restless Leg Tour that they mm-hmm. were on together, and it was just, wow, gorgeous. The thing that stuck out to me the most from Bossy Pants was when Tina talked about both being fat and skinny. And mm-hmm. I have been both fat and skinny. Mm-hmm. And I think about that all the time and how like the world feels different under each of those different circumstances. And yet you're still yourself and you still embody yourself. And like, there's just like lots of those relatable moments in Bossy Pants. And it's like mm-hmm. really palatable. I love mm-hmm. it.
How would you describe your life today, Mal?
It is full and it's content and it's authentic and integral. Like I feel like I live a life of integrity, and I mm-hmm. don't know that I could have said that, you know, 6 years ago, 7, 8, 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was living a life that I was told I should live, that should make me happy.
You worked so hard to make it. I mean, what you and your ex-husband did to make both for both of you, you worked so hard to try to live to a standard that it sounds like you both were like trying so hard and mm-hmm. realized that it just wasn't for you.
Yeah. And I think about my interactions. So last night, Amanda and I actually went to go see Esther Perel speak at
the. Oh, really? How was she?
It was cool. It was neat to see her in person. But, you know, she was talking about like how important it is to openly and honestly communicate and be vulnerable and like, you know, really say what you need and speak up and like, you know, honor your partner's version of reality versus your version of reality. And like, that's what we do. And like, I want to brag for a second about this relationship that I have, because it's like, we are so full of integrity in the choices and the disclosures and the communications that we have with one another. And because of that, it feels so safe and it feels so secure and comforting. And like, I hope that anybody who's listening to this and who's like in limbo and thinking about whether or not life could be different or should be different, like it can, and you just have to trust yourself and your knowing and start making the choices that are right for you and not right for other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to let that be the last word. So okay. Mal, thank you so much. For coming. I could talk to you for hours about this stuff because I think this is both what we do. So I'm really excited. Reach out to Mal. It's really wonderful if you, you know, having, especially, do you take insurance, especially? I'm curious.
I don't. I do provide a super bill for out-of-network benefits if that's a part of your plan.
Yeah, it's because a lot of times people are looking, I'm not a therapist, so a lot of times people are looking for a therapist. So if you're in one of the four states that Mal serves, she can help you with that, but also look up the Fireflies. There's lots of different communities out there. I would say, you know, I have a community, Mal has a community, there's other communities out there, find the one that fits you. Now, you know, it used to be back in the day, literally less than 10 years ago, there was one. are
yeah,
too.
Lavender vision.
Now there's literally, I probably could think of 10 off the top of my head. And so find the community that fits you and your needs. You know,
firefly glow that matches.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes, you know, somebody, you know, and like sometimes people have more of a specialty, like Mal is a therapist. I'm somebody can really help you deconstruct religion because I'm an ordained minister. And so it's something I've thought about. So like, really go and find the one that works for you. Talk to us all and find the one that works for you. It's so nice that we have options now and you just can't sort of, you don't have to just go with the only thing there is. So thank you very much.
Thank you so very much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here and a privilege.
You've been listening to Coming Out and Beyond LGBTQIA+ Stories with Anne-Marie Zanzel. New episodes of the Coming Out and Beyond podcast drop every other Friday. You can tune in at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and at annemariezanzel.com. Be sure to hit subscribe when tuning in so you never miss an episode. And for more resources, articles, videos, and a free downloadable guide for coming out later in life, visit annemariezanzel.com.